May the sacred presence of the one who said he would abide in this teaching be our guide. May we follow his glorious example and tread with unfaltering step this noble path until we too shall attain enlightenment.
All of us throughout space and time, all 100 ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha, prajna, paramita.
Good evening.
Good evening.
As Carrie was reading that verse, I was looking out over this group of you and remembering at the very first precepts class, I was like, oh my God, there's so many people, I don't know any of them. Like now, how many faces I recognize and how many names I know, how many stories I get a little bit of it with. Sorry. Very sweet. So this is the fourth of the precepts classes. First one we talked about the Kyoji Kaimon, the second one we talked about Sange and contrition and refuge. The third one we talked about, what did we do last week?
I know where we are now.
So tonight we're going to look at the precepts through this lens of recognition and talk a little bit about the recognition ceremony is one of the most secret public ceremonies that we do, so I'm not going to talk about the ceremony, but different aspects of recognition in the precepts. And that'll be Saturday night during Zaijika, if you want to. And then what I'd like to do, or what we'd like to do, is after we talk a little bit about recognition, shifting more towards that, looking at the individual precepts, this time probably without the paper airplanes. But inviting you to bring forward like what it is you're curious about, what's alive for you, what phrasing has you confused or uncertain, how do you relate to these, and just hear more about how people are working with that. Sound good?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, a story. This is a story that my teacher once used in a Dharma talk. Some of you may be familiar with this little story, but it's a story about a concrete Buddha in Oakland. And Kyogen ran across this story when it sort of first happened and first became public knowledge. And there was a gentleman in Oakland who lived in a neighborhood that had a particular part that attracted debris and litter and old mattresses and just sort of things that most people didn't want around. And so one day he ran out to his local hardware store and he bought this concrete Buddha and decided he was just going to put it where all of that debris accumulated and see what happened. So he was worried about the Buddha getting stolen, so he put in some rebar and attached it to the ground some way so it would be there. And he did this sort of out of a sense of being fed up. He was fed up with all of this junk being dumped in his neighborhood and like wanted to reclaim that part of his neighborhood. And what he noticed was over time there was less and less of that debris around, and people noticed the Buddha. And there were some neighbors who were Vietnamese Buddhists, and they built a little shrine, a little enclosure for the Buddha. And then there were offerings left outside, perhaps a small pile of oranges or apples. Sometimes the neighbors would come and chant at this little shrine. And at one point, the city noticed that there was this shrine and there was this Buddha, and it jutted out just a little bit past where it should be. And they thought about removing it. They told the neighborhood that they were going to take it down. And there was this big uproar from the neighborhood. They wanted to keep it, that it was a part of their neighborhood. It was a place of devotion, and that they really, really did not want the city to tear this down. It's now become a thing to see in Oakland. You can look at travel guides for that part of the city, and they say, be sure to stop by and see the concrete Buddha in Oakland. And, you know, the guy who put it there had been interviewed by a number of newspapers, local papers, mostly some national papers, and he was just like, I'm not a Buddhist. I just, like, I saw this thing and I thought it might, He said, a Buddha is a neutral thing. People don't have strong feelings about the image of a Buddha. I just wanted to put something there to see what would happen. And I was like, I don't see the Buddha as a neutral thing. Apparently the neighborhood didn't see the Buddha as a neutral thing either. And so it became a place of respect and a place of neighborhood pride. And so I wanted to bring the story forward. I can't remember all what Tobin talked about when he gave his Dharma talk about it, but I wanted to bring it forward with this topic of recognition in terms of, like, when we work with the precepts, when we turn towards the precepts, where do we start to notice the precepts coming alive in our life? We often think of it as a heady thing, like I'm thinking about the precepts or I'm changing my action in the precepts. But sometimes as we start working the precepts, we start noticing, oh, I saw what they did. I saw what they did. And you start noticing those kindnesses, those ways people relate to each other that aren't self-serving or self-centered. In Zen, especially, we talk about way-seeking mind, that first thought of turning towards practice, that first thought of turning towards something greater than ourselves, something that we can use as a guide, something that lets us know that wholesome action really isn't that scary. And so I'm very curious, especially for those who have been doing the recitation and recollection practice, are you seeing these aspects popping up in your life, or is it still just an internal view, an internal practice? Corey, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I'm seeing myself living out, you know, there's, when you sit with that intention during the day, it becomes alive, you know, it's animated. It's not passive anymore, and you have to reconcile within yourself, you know, these different dimensions and what they mean to you. But yeah, just seeing them acted out through the ways that people operate. I'm in grocery stores every day doing demos and seeing reality unfold before me and feeling into my own intentions, you know, in those every moments. And it's altered my relationship to myself, thinking, one, before it was mindfulness as being just kind of this clear state, now there's content to it, something by which to measure it with.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been thinking about the do not kill precept, because you know, I've been thinking about whether to stop eating meat, and I just happened upon this pamphlet, and it had these really strong athletes, you know, and they were saying, "I am vegan," and I thought, "Well, this is interesting." And then we have a mouse in the house. And, you know, we put a little trap down with some peanut butter, and somehow the mouse got the peanut butter without the trap. So, you know, I'm thinking, well, maybe I should see if there's like a little box so you catch the mouse and then let it go. And that just how hard it is not to kill things, like when you're growing crops and stuff, you know, there's, you know, I was infestated. One of my trees was infestated with something, and I had to kill those little bugs. So I don't know a lot about that.
That'll be a great one to talk about when we get to the discussion, when we start talking about the various aspects of the precepts. So remember to come back to that one. Did you have
any? No, did you went back?
Okay. question then. As we start working with the precepts and taking them into our lives, what catches your attention and what do you shy away from? Has any of that shifted? And these can be as general or as specific as you like. Yeah, Rachel.
I just keep stumbling on and thinking about do not condone haphazard talk. And I just don't think I had any realization or understanding of how much I participate in that. But it's all the time. So I've just been a lot more aware of that in the last few weeks. And I'm trying to just change my response when I'm like, oh, this person, and oh, this just irritates me, that da-da-da-da. And it's, I will have to keep working on it.
There's something funny about that, because there is such an inclination to share that kind of frustration and have somebody sort of have your back and say, yeah, you're justified. And the talk itself can be harmful, but at the same time, there's an essence of connection there that I'm very curious about. Like, we're so social. So the question then becomes, how do you create connection without causing harm in the process? Which can be a very tricky thing to do. But I'm noticing we're jumping into the specifics of precepts, so I'm willing to give up the rest of what I was going to say about recognition and let's just do precepts.
What about invisibility?
What about invisibility?
What about
invisibility?
What about what?
Go ahead.
I was going to say that the haphazard talk one, to me, I always, it makes me think of the first one, cease from evil, release all self-attachment. Because I notice if I join in the haphazard talk to make that connection, what I'm doing is I'm joining the club, which is perpetuating my self-identity. So I'm attaching to this identity of myself, and it's creating a self attached to you or inside the inside club. That's what I think about. I think about I don't need to join. I don't need to be who I am. I don't need to prop up myself or my ego by joining that club. I can join that club through wholesome action as opposed to the gossip or the haphazard talk about other people.
Do you ever feel lonely?
No. I feel pathos for just the situation.
I don't think anybody has said pathos in the research classes I've
had. The whole situation just makes me go, so sad. I don't generally feel.
And it's tricky, you know, because when people are trying to bond with you in that way, like, I don't know. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not like an easy solution just to like put the hands, you know?
Yeah. It's hard to say something that doesn't make the other person think that you're saying you're better than them, and after all, cease from evil and self-attachment, and like, oh, wait a minute, I just made it worse. You know, so it's better just go on.
So there's a way in which, with the precepts, if we really, really dive into them like this, that we can work ourselves into a state of paralysis. We can work ourselves into a state of like almost deep dark, my mere existence causes harm. Which in a way is true. But we also have so much to offer. Right? We have so much vitality and so much life force and so much capacity to move towards wholesome action. that to do nothing is also causing harm. So, given all of these impossible precepts, impossible to hold completely precepts, how do we leap forward into life exuberantly, joyously, and go forward and be good Buddhists?
Oh,
we're not.
Yeah. So on my way here, I got cut off 4 times and 3 lights and almost hit, which is interesting given what I do for a living. So I was getting really grumpy about it. And here on the radio, there was a piece about a jazz man named Wayne Schroeder, who was a Buddhist in the 1950s. And at one point, he decided that what he was going to do was to evolve. And for him to do that, that meant to be happy. And by that, he meant writing music that was happy. And so it turns out one of my favorite jazz pieces called Mama G, which is a very, and so they played that right after that. And so I walked in here in a very different mood. So thank you, Ray Trover. But I just thought that was so interesting that they should bring up the fact that I've been listening to this music for years and had no idea he was a Buddha.
Yeah. Some people are more private with their Buddhist identity than others.
Yes.
Some are invisible.
Oh, okay. I was trying to think of a segue.
Can we get a superpower here?
Actually, so one of the things that I wanted to bring up in conjunction with this idea of recognition, and so recognition, one being celebration of way-seeking mind. People get excited around Japan, like, oh, this is a Buddhist, that we're making a Buddhist, this is great. It's a celebration of way-seeking mind. People are coming to practice, and there is something very delightful in witnessing that, in seeing that, in being able to share that with people. So we have recognition as celebration of way-seeking mind. We have recognition in terms of watching how Dharma manifests in your life, like noticing those points of experience that have some Dharma meaning that we can see. And then there's also this flip side of recognition in that there are times where sometimes in formal practice, we may advise someone to do invisible practice. And by that I mean doing a kindness for someone else in such a way that you're not recognized.
What? Secret Santa?
but things like straightening shoes or putting away dishes or just doing something small that benefits more than yourself, where you're never, like, think of all the times we do something kind and there's that part that wants that recognition, that, like, I did a good thing. Did you see that? Did you see that? Did you see how kind I am? Did you see how nice I am?
Or the flip side, maybe I'm not a piece of crap.
Or maybe I'm not a piece of crap.
Yeah.
But just looking at this aspect of practice and how much of it is wanting that connection and wanting that recognition, and how much can be done subtly and invisibly. And even if you can do it invisibly, how often do you catch yourself saying, I did that invisibly? There's nothing wrong with that, but it's a place where the self gets caught. It's a place where we can reify an identity. I'm the one who saves the last cookie for somebody else. Yep, there's the cookie. There's always a cookie.
And I'm the one who cleans all the wipers at work and everything else.
Yeah.
Outlet covers.
Outlet covers? Can you explain outlet covers?
So, like, one of my things, I have to check safety. And, like, so just automatically, I notice outlets and whether they have covers or not.
Oh.
Because we work with young children. And so, like,
something that drives me crazy is when I replace an outlet cover that someone took off without replacing, and then the next week the same cover is off, and then when I write, please put back, the same thing is off. So this is my continuous, like, oh, outlet covers. Just that recognition that just comes up all the time.
Sometimes invisible, sometimes that's human, that's what we do. So does that make sense, that quality of invisible practice? When I trained at Zen Mountain Monastery, they told me the story, I don't know if it's true or not, but they told me the story that on retreats, the Shuso was supposed to go clean all the bathrooms in the middle of the night so nobody knew, but everybody knew that this was part of what the Shuso did during the night. So I think about that often in terms of this recognition and invisible practice, if that really counts, if everybody knows that you're secretly going down. Anyway, I'm starting to digress. So let's come back to precepts. What's the life for you all? What do you have questions about? What do you want to know about? What are there phrases or precepts or dakota?
Something that recently came up for me during the recitation practice is the do not be mean with the Dharma or wealth. Share understanding you freely of self.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember the commentary verbatim, but the sort of, like, it seems strange because I think it says that basically being jealous of nothing is the precept of sharing understanding, kind of, of not being mean with Dharma or wealth.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious about that one because it seems to me that it just seems strange.
Mm-hmm.
Because jealous seems to me like that I want something else that someone else has,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the spirit of it seems to be to share what one already does have.
Mm-hmm.
What if you replace jealous with stingy?
Stingy.
Mm-hmm.
Carrie, would you read the commentary?
Yeah, and also I have some extra ones if anybody would. So, do not be mean with Dharma or wealth. Share understanding and freely of self. In the genuine all-pervading Dharma, being jealous of nothing is the precept of not being mean with Dharma or wealth. One phrase, one verse, that is the 10,000 things and 100 grasses. One Dharma, one realization, that is all Buddhas and Dharma ancestors. From the beginning, not one thing has been begrudged.
So
it seems like there's this, of course, I mean, all of them have all of the other ones in them.
Yeah.
But something about, like, the way that it's phrased, especially the commentary, it's just like it really kind of sticks out to me. And specifically just that. But maybe I'm misunderstanding the way jealous is being used in this context.
Or, yep. Let's see what other people have to say.
For me, this jumps right out as, like, workplace power guarding. Just as, like, the easiest example to latch onto, and then I can kind of, like, extrapolate out from that and see how people guard their own knowledge and guard their own control over things. Money is like very obvious, but much more subtle kinds of acquisition and power and control all seem to apply here. And the moment that you start to guard your own knowledge, I think is where you fall down on this precept.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Workplace power seems like the easiest analog,
mm-hmm.
but you know I can see it in every direction.
Mm-hmm.
for me, jealousy and giving freely of self, both of those things can get really subtle.
Mm-hmm.
I do have sort of a jealous thread in my personality, and sometimes it shows up as, for instance, you know, because I grew up in like poverty. Sometimes I look at people who didn't, and maybe I see them struggling in the moment, and I think to myself, you know, but you know, they've had it good before, so what makes them deserving of like my understanding or compassion this time?
Mm-hmm.
Which is an embarrassing admission.
Mm-hmm.
But I catch myself, you know, doing that. So it doesn't have to be necessarily, you have something right now that I want and I don't have, so you know, like I'm not gonna be open to you. It can even be something like something about, you know, who they are or where they're coming from, or something that makes me feel separate from them.
Mm-hmm.
And less inclined to be open to them. And so it gets subtle. I guess I have to be really careful when that pops up.
I actually also have a little story that I think goes along with that, telling a story on myself. I started complaining to Gyokoko one time. This is not wise. about another Sangha member who I was having trouble with. And it had to do with, I felt like she was being whiny. You know, she was doing a lot of whining. It just really bugged me. And Gyokoko said, "Well, it sounds like you have a little envy." I was like, "What?" I was just outraged. What do you mean, envy? But I went away and thought about it, and I thought, you know, I never got away with being whiny.
Yeah, that's exactly what I
never got away with that. How does she get away with that? Right? So, I mean, that's another way to think about jealousy, is that, you know, I'm envying something. And I've seen myself do this with other kinds of things. It's like, I can't get away with that. How can they do that? And it's like, that's not fair, right? So there's a little, you know, I think Gyokoko nailed it, even though I was outraged at it. She just totally nailed it. Yeah, watch it with her.
Outraged.
So I'm gonna take this from the specific to the abstract a bit, going back to your question, Dakota. So in the genuine all-pervading Dharma, being jealous of nothing is the precept. Is that the right commentary? Am I reading that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, being jealous of nothing is the precept of not being
in the Dharma. So in the genuine all-pervading Dharma, this Dharma that is accessible to everyone everywhere, what is the point of being jealous if everyone has access to it? What is the point of looking at someone else and saying, you have more, I want more? It is equally accessible to all. So the beauty of the way the Kyoji Kaimon is structured, one of the things that I continue to be so grateful for and so impressed with is because we can drill down into the very specific and see like the granular aspects of our lives, and we can go very absolute and be reminded of the fact that this Dharma is accessible to all. This Dharma is available to all. This Dharma manifests for everyone. All we need to do is turn towards it. It's present right here. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
All right. It's a parable from the Lotus Sutra. And it's a parable that says that in this parable, in this story, it's a parable of the medicinal herbs. So there are all of these herbs and shrubs and small trees, and the Dharma falls like rain, and each plant takes up what it needs. So the big plants take up what the big plants need, and the small plants take up what the small plants need. And each soaks up what it needs. It's a beautiful
a beautiful thing.
And it reminds me of recognition.
How so?
You don't have to be jealous of anything. Because you are everything.
Mm-hmm.
Or nothing. I guess what I like about the process is just... there are so many different levels. Like, you can't get bored with them. And just, like, it can be like, oh, I should share my dark chocolate with my child. Or, or, like, I should be present with this person in front of me. I should really be present. That's what's been coming up for me lately.
Where's the should coming from?
Hmm?
Where's the should coming from?
Did I say should? See, that was invisible for me. So yeah, when I look at this, I just see all those different levels. And when I hear everybody talking, I'm hearing people echoing similar things as they're going through their day. This has come up, or this has come up. And how it just changes shape over time. Is there another precept that is coming?
What? We have the do not kill.
Oh yeah, do not kill. We just had a conversation about that before we came over here, so it's just so interesting. Would anyone like to comment on the do not kill?
I was thinking about the Oakland Buddha story. I like when you get to the do not kill, when it says the Buddha increases with life and continue the life. I was thinking of the Buddha story where even putting the Buddha there is unintentional, but it's, or I mean, it wasn't a Buddhist practice, but it was a kind, good thought for the field, and then we all share in it and move it forward, whether it's part of a practice or not, and we're kind of continuing the life of our shared life.
Mm-hmm.
It comes up for me every year with precepts, how often we break the precepts on purpose, and we know that there's going to be karma with it, but things as simple as telling somebody that the dinner they made tasted wonderful when you wanted to go and spit it out in the bathroom, or euthanasia for an animal when they're suffering. The mice, you know, I have live traps, but I recently talked to somebody that had an overabundance of mice that was getting into food and out in by the horses and a lot of other things that they felt like they didn't have an option. Or even just killing mosquitoes when you're totally freaked out, you know? So I think that's what comes up for me every precept, is that there's things that we choose to do that we know is clearly against what our precepts guide us to do, but it's the compassionate thing to do, or in the moment you feel like it's the only option to do. And so I think that's what comes up, especially with the do not kill. I think even just killing somebody's spirit, you know, if you tell your grandmother that her food was awful, you know, it's just not the okay thing to do. So
I think that brings up the paradox of the precepts.
Mm-hmm.
You keep getting into it. Like, you're lying when you say it's wonderful. But then if you say it was horrible, you're killing her spirit. And so originally I wrote some scenarios for the class, but they were a little bit graphic, and one of them was about the mice situation, because living in the country, there's mice everywhere. But what if the mice have hantavirus and you have a young child?
You know what I mean? Like, there's so much paradox. Like, that's just a simple paradox. But, like, that's where you start to really see the intersection of the precepts. I think the precept practice makes you more aware of those moments, though, right? Would anyone else like to add? Ever?
For me, I want to be careful with this one because the vegetarian thing is a hot button topic. And so, you know, what's right for me, I understand isn't right for everybody. But for me, the do not kill ended up being a little bit more about allowing reverence in my life, making sure that I had time for reflection and feeling what it was that I'm really feeling. I have this particular memory after I moved here. I'd been wanting to be a vegetarian for a while. And I wasn't able to because I was a chef. And the community was, in my particular culinary community, like being a vegetarian was like being the devil. So we didn't do that. But when I moved here, I had the opportunity to give it a try. And I worked, but I still worked in a job where we prepared meat and did that. And we actually went to go tour the place where the birds were kept and where they were slaughtered. And it was, in terms of like how animals are treated, it's like top notch. It's a really great place. But I had this experience of we went into this pen, and a little baby goose ran up to me and wrapped its neck around my neck. And then right after that experience, which brought me to tears, there was something very moving about that. We went in toward the slaughter area. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so for me, it was a very powerful moment of contemplation. What I ended up coming to is that to say... to look away from something that so genuinely seemed to bother me was like killing myself. If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's ingenuine, and it's cutting off my reverence, my personal reverence. But I know that it's different for everyone. And so yeah, for me it's just about being in touch with that, being in touch with what. So you know, you have reverence for your child. We're doing the best we can, you know. So yeah,
thank you.
I think with do not kill, it's again, there's a level of impossibility with all of them, and I think there's like, because I mean, even as we're all talking and breathing in, right, there's probably little organisms that are going into our, like, there's just so many things. Whenever we wash our hands, we're killing things. Mm-hmm. So part of what the thing the precepts open up to me is this question of, okay, clearly there's gradations of how deep you can go into this, right? Like, you can, in one sense, I think you can honor do not kill and eat meat. But you could also honor it in a different way by doing things like what Jainists do, right? Where they only eat the fruit and the nuts that fall off of the trees. And that's a... like, there's just very serious gradations of how deep one can go into the layers of subtlety that are here. But I think part of what Ember was saying about that reverence aspect, is I think part of where that, like, cultivate and encourage life can really come in, which is why we say things like the five thoughts, especially that first thought, right? Like, we reflect on the effort that brought us this food and consider how it comes to us. Like, having that moment, to me, there's a sense of, like, encouraging and respecting and honoring the life that we're taking in that allows us to go on doing this practice, to go on, you know, being people. But it is hard, and this is that aspect where it just, all of the precepts, for me, at least, have been opening me up to, like, just, like, the intuitive, like, okay, what does this moment call for in terms of this really myriad and complex and beautiful world that we live in. And in this moment, what is the action that shines forth with the most authenticity in honoring some of those things?
Yeah, I just want to add that as we work with the precepts, there's an aspect of them that is an external support. They're written down, they're on paper, we can put them up on our fridge. But the investigation and the doing of them comes from within. And so that assessment or discernment of the degree to which we're going to keep them subtle or gross or in between really comes from that internal experience. So alignment with the precepts comes from within. It's not imposed from without. So in terms of how we hold a precept of not killing, especially around eating meat or not, that's still an internal personal decision to make. I think I said the other week that there aren't any precept police running around and da-da-da-da-da. So when we talk about how we work with the precepts, we talk about them as guidelines or talk about them as guideposts, something to turn towards. Those are great. When we start getting into rules, I start getting a little twitchy because I don't quite see them as rules or something very black and white. Said that all of the precepts are held within each other. We can't hold them completely, and yet if we break one, we break all of them. So there's all sorts of these little paradoxes in there. And I'm not sure where I was going with that, but you want to think about it.
Okay.
Yeah. I just want to say I really appreciate what Ember said about reverence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just that really brings that home to me because it's working on those internal levels as well as how we engage and interact and fit into the world around us. And that reverence kind of just connects everything. It's really beautiful. And just what you said too, it's just really touching. Having the reverence and having our eyes open with the reverence as the moment is unfolding. Any other precepts that have been kind of like percolating?
Everybody's speaking so eloquently, and I really appreciate being in this group. To me, the precepts, I try to keep them as simple as possible, because if I go too far down that rabbit hole, then I start questioning everything, and almost you get seized up, locked up to where you can't move, particularly when you're going throughout the course of your day, trying to get done what you need to get done, but still trying to live by the precepts. So I just look at them softly. And someone was talking about the jealousy one, and that happened just the other day. I am naturally not a jealous person, and if a jealousy arises within me, I have to stop and look at it. I go, okay, what is it that I'm jealous about? And think about it. And then look at that person and go, well, now wait a minute. Didn't they just leave their house last year? Didn't they, you need to turn the jealousy around and translate that into happiness for the person. And so that's almost my automatic response to jealousy is, what is it that I need to be happy for them about? And then I don't focus on the jealous part. Only if they're really tall and can eat anything they want all day long. Myself coming from a family of celluloid-ridden hobbits.
That I'm still working on. But everything else I'm good with.
And I'm happy for everything.
Thank you for sharing. I think that's what I love, is like it has the positive part that goes with the negative part, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, communicate truthfully, polish clarity, create wisdom from ignorance, you know? And I think that just, it just opens it up and it allows that life force, you know, to be a living life practice. And also I like the three simple pure precepts, you know? Like cease from evil.
Are they simple?
Let's say you're really tired because you haven't had enough sleep and you can't remember all of the grave precepts. It's just like cease from evil.
And eat your dark chocolate.
I mean, honestly, that has saved me so many times just because of, like, not getting enough sleep, especially when my daughter was younger, like, working all the time, going to school all the time, studying all the time, not sleeping. Like, if I was feeling, like, angry and impatient, cease from evil. Like, seriously, that was a lifesaver for me, just, like, that first. So sometimes simple words.
Do we have a sense of what we're talking about when we talk about evil in this particular setting?
I see it as causing harm to others. That was my interpretation. Like, I wouldn't want to cause harm. Mm-hmm.
I was just thinking, I mean, since it goes with release all self-attachment, I feel like that's the sort of core of everything. Mm-hmm. Like, all the precepts are right there in this beginning of releasing all self-attachment, which is so hard. And I think if thinking about the way that unfolds in almost every moment for me has really, really been sort of painful and helpful simultaneously, you know? So I feel like that the evil, at least, is really about self-attachment. I was thinking about earlier when you were talking about seeing this play out in the day. I work with people who live out on the streets, and so I spend a lot of time with folks who are really just trying to get by out on the streets. And one thing that I admire so much is how direct, how there's no, every interaction is entirely direct, and I started seeing it as a sort of a loss of self-attachment that seemed really beautiful and intentional. And I'm not trying to sugarcoat how difficult it is to be living out on the street, don't get me wrong. But there's something about things being stripped away that I see a lot of people interacting with one another in a direct way that I don't see when I interact with people who have more of their needs. Needs met, maybe. And it's really interesting to me to see that first grave, pure precept playing out on the street, interaction after interaction after interaction. It's interesting.
Thank you. So I've been struggling in being a good mentor with my youngest, who's in college, on the precept about not misusing sexuality. I'm trying to help her navigate the fact that that's part of what going to college is about. trying to find a way to have relationships and honor those relationships, and yet she struggles a lot because she's such a tomboy, and she grew up with brothers, and so she's much more comfortable in the company of men, and she's only a small cadre of girlfriends, but a lot of times it just makes a lot of room for misunderstandings. And for me, I kept coming back to cease from evil. And it was more about doing harm and also just being aware of her power as a woman, and her power especially because she's so accessible in terms of her personality and just getting to know her and things like that. But being aware that is her way of not misusing her sexuality, because she's not overtly sexual or mm-hmm. promiscuous or anything like that. It's just that she is so easy to talk to. She's so easy to banter with and, yeah, to be around. You're a geeky college boy.
I think it's amazing you can actually have those conversations with your daughter.
Oh, well, it's her fault. She thinks I'm wonderful, though. I'm not going to try to dissuade that. Yeah, I've got her hoodwinked.
So there's an interesting situation there in that you're looking at the precept, but you're thinking about it in terms of her behavior, right?
Not as much her behavior, but just being aware of who she is and what effect she has on people, mm-hmm. and understanding that there are benefits and consequences, and that you want the consequence of being all that you can be to be something that isn't going to be harmful.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. For me, this precept kind of just is cease. And I don't usually get to the evil part. Because I feel like when I work with sort of precepts, but only that process of really feeling into the point at which I know I'm entangled in some way and requires that pause. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's sort of like a skidding, you know, to contend, and sometimes it's just a falling flat or whatever, but that cease from evil always just, I don't even really read or see the from evil part, it's just sort of cease.
Thank you. Like it makes me think of something like the sword, you know, just like cutting and just being very freed by that, right? Mm-hmm. Releasing self-attachment.
Mm-hmm. Oftentimes Manjushri is depicted with a sword that cuts through delusion.
And I was going to say that, but I feel like that's going to be like one of those weird things I say.
I was debating asking a question. I wasn't sure how to ask it, and it was about how I'm having certain pains, right, and certain emotions, etc., etc., as we're all human. And I keep on thinking there has to be a precept here, but I can't quite pinpoint it. And I was like, how do I say that? Because I'm sure there is one, but I haven't figured out it, so I probably won't say it. And it's funny because I barely acknowledged this when I, you know, recited cease from evil, and it's like one is like, oh, that's it, and another part of me is saying, oh, that's it, until the rest figures it out. But for now it's like, oh, cease from evil is kind of not like a blanket, but it's kind of, I don't know, it takes a lot of the unknown out. It's like you don't have to figure it out, just cease from evil.
Mm-hmm. 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 In that sense, it is very simple.
And it makes me think of like when we are feeling really strong emotions, that we're not necessarily like thinking with our best brain, and so we just need something simple just to like.
I was wondering on the do not speak dishonestly, the part about putting forth not one word, mm-hmm. is the precept of not speaking dishonestly, which contradicts in some way, to me, the communicate truthfully part, and I'm not able to wrap my mind around put forth not one word in terms of how that relates.
It has to do with the wisdom sutras.
That's just one of the weird things you say.
I'm joking, you rescue me.
You're trying to phone a friend on this one?
I see it as putting forth that one word is the equivalent of silence. So if I don't say anything, I'm likely to get in less trouble if I just bob and be quiet. Another way of saying it is what I'm about to say an improvement over silence? That's another thing that people say. But then also silence can promote dishonesty. Mm-hmm. So like, do I say something? Do I not say something?
So what's the wisdom sutra angle?
You know,
I just mean my two cents sometimes, and it doesn't necessarily mean it's like a good two cents.
the emptiness angle. Mm-hmm. I mean, the emptiness angle is throughout all of these. You know,
yes.
I mean, it's like the inexplicable dharma, right? And so. It's pointing to that ultimate truth that you really can't describe with words. So I think it's broader than that, but there's a bit of that where it's pointing at once you try to describe ultimate truth, you literally can't. So
right, because anytime you try to describe it, you're like chalking it into pieces.
Yeah, and it's not an honest depiction. Is what? Yeah.
Right, because if you're talking about everything, you're like, that's everything. But that's not really everything.
Or you can speak to the fact that we can't communicate completely with words. Mm-hmm. That it's always an approximation, it's always falling short somehow. Mm-hmm. And yet with that other precept that says communicate truthfully, we're bound to trust. So it puts the ball in our court in terms of taking responsibility for how we interact with others. And both the mind with which we interact and the method with which we interact as well. How much are we hiding? How much are we willing to disclose? How much do we twist and manipulate? Mm-hmm. Right, Carrie, you've got hands everywhere.
I was looking at them.
This one gets me really twisted because I find that what I tend to do is that if I'm that not speaking dishonestly sometimes means not saying something that needs to be said. Yeah, and I've grown up in a family culture where that's just, you just don't say it. And anything nice to say, don't say it. Mm-hmm. And yet sometimes I find that that feels dishonest. Mm-hmm. Non-saying something, I mean, obviously you want to say it in a way that comes from a place of compassion. So anyway, this one just twists me.
It goes well with the do only good. It goes well with the, in my view, with the do only good.
Yeah.
So is what I can I speak in such a way that is both true and kind.
Yeah.
Like it could be true but not kind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could be kind but not true.
Right.
But can I get the two in the right balance?
Mm-hmm.
So do only good kind of goes pairs well with this one in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or do good for others.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, those are right.
Yeah.
It kind of makes me think of like a festering wound, you know, like you just kind of like hide it away and just try to ignore it. Like you can just like make your tissue die. But if you like give it light and open it to the air, then it can heal.
Well, it goes to the thing about not stealing and just to me by not, but by being dishonest in that way, for me, I'm robbing myself of a relationship with them or them with me, because it's not an honest relationship. Where there's this wall that they may not even realize is there, but because of that wall, and over time, you don't have, the possibilities are not open. So I feel like that's a way of stealing. So that's why it gets me all wound up, because I know that was wrong.
They're all interconnected.
I think the precept study guide has a really interesting point on this one in particular, in terms of sort of like a sense of silence when we are speaking, like an inner sort of silence. And I think what I'm thinking of now, I guess, is what if it is more of a like paying attention to when, to whether or not that sense of stillness, that sense of silence is there when we move to speak. Because sometimes I can move to speak with like an angry or a panicky sort of motion, or sometimes something within me saying like, you know, this isn't the right way to put this, this like something about this isn't quite right. And getting in tune with that a little bit more and trying to be curious about it and then rediscover that sense of stillness. And I think from that, hopefully, I don't know, I have to try this now, but, you know, the authentic expression can arise a little bit more easily. Or at least we reconnect with what the authentic expression would be. But that's, you know, that's not always going to come very easily, you know, if we're in the middle of a very intense discussion or something, but I think that there's, beyond that external aspect of things, that internal silence can also be a really important part of this kind of thing.
Diana, are you trying to raise your hand?
Yeah, I just want to thank you for that, because the sweet dew covers the earth and within it lies the truth just kills me. And I don't, because it's so wonderful, and yet I have no idea what it meant. And talking about this idea of stillness and quiet made this make so much sense to me all of a sudden. You know, so thanks.
I think that's a good note to end on. We're at 8:55. Now I'd like to invite people to Vespers. One thing I want to ask you to consider is we have 6 weeks of class. We'll do it for 5-6. There are 5 ceremonies of Daijukai that we've been using to look through this, the lens of the precepts with. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. What happened from that last class? So the question for you is, what is it that you would really like to learn or explore on that last class? And if you go home and think about it, and at the next class, come and bring those ideas. Carrie and I can incorporate that, and we'll wrap that into this last class for you. So if there's a point that we haven't hit yet that you're curious about, if there's some of the poetic imagery you're curious about, if it's like, how do you do this in real life, in real time, sort of a thing, if you want us to role play a situation or some such thing.
I can just throw the scenarios that I wrote.
So here's the deal. Like, we can stand up here and ask questions and facilitate discussions and do some instruction, but this is really about your life. So think about how you're working with these precepts in your life, and if there is something that you would like to explore
let us know the next class and we'll incorporate it into the last one. Because
so is this four?
This is four. Good. So we've got something planned for five, and then we're trying to, like, what do you guys want for six to sort of wrap it up and bring things home and get ready for retreat?
Not contriving reality for self.
Yeah.
That's always a good one.
Put that one down.
That is a good one.
I'll remember it because that's something, you know.
But that's familiar. That's doable. You guys willing to roll with that?
Yes.
Okay. Great. Thank you all very much. Thank you. And we'll have Vespers and Zendo.